Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
And I'm going to turn the correct mic up this time, Josh,
this
I promise.
This is attempt two.
Yeah. Oh, well.
So.
No. We do it perfectly every week without making a single mistake. That's why we don't edit this show at all.
Yeah, that's why we have bloopers, right? So, I have sexlexia. If I have sexlexia, where can I go to help my sexlexia?
In the butt?
Where can I go to buy things for
in
the butt?
Oh, okay. Well, sexlexia, you get the wrong side. What you can do is you can go to adamandeve.com. And they have tons of products, everything from lingerie to movies to
butt
toys
products
for him and her and things that vibrate and things that pulsate and things that make other things really slippery.
And things that look like they're the size of traffic cones. Yeah. I can't imagine that going into a human body.
I've seen it.
Okay. But you go to adamandeve.com and use the promo code STATIC. And you
STATIC.
And you get 3 free DVDs, 50% off of a single item.
Yes.
Free shipping in the United States, and even a free mystery gift that's so mysterious, it's a mystery gift.
That was the dumbest line I've heard in a long time for that promo.
It was pragmatic. A mystery gift is mysterious because it's a mystery. Think about it on a pragmatic level. It makes sense, right?
Anyway.
And then also, go to 1201beyond.com and go to use, if you're going to use Amazon, and use the Amazon links on the webpage and shop, and it helps us out. And you guys know all this.
Yeah, just get it out in the air. Yes, we get a percentage of whatever you spend at Amazon. We get a percentage of whatever
you spend at
Adam and Eve. So don't do the $5 order for you and $5 order for your grandma and $5 order for your dog and $5 order for this all at the same house anymore.
That's how we lost the sponsorship in the first place.
That's how we lost the sponsorship in the first place.
Our listeners were abusing the codes.
Yes, we appreciate it.
No, the codes are not for abuse. The things you get with the codes are for abuse.
There you go. Well, some of them.
See, no, that wasn't a bad one, was it?
That was good. Just ride the segue right on through there.
Yeah. Now, tonight's topic, it's not going to be serious, but it is going to be serious.
We've had some pretty light subjects in the recent past.
Oh yeah,
here, so.
Yeah, like our political episode.
Yeah,
totally,
I mean,
light with
you
me
know,
screaming
just
and rage,
letting it go. So
tonight, I want to ask you: are you able to separate? And when I say man, I don't mean man as male. I mean man as individual,
as in the person.
Yes. Are you able to separate a man from his art, whether that's art, whether that's filmmaking, whether that's music, whether that is just ideas, whether it's writing, whatever? Are you able to separate maybe an awful, awful human being in real life to an amazing artist?
Really depends on the artist. And I'm not kidding. One that I can't separate. One that has such a distinct style and really lived his style of art in his life as well as in his art, was Andy Warhol. I can't separate Andy Warhol from his art simply because he was that amazingly, I mean, he was a force of the 1960s, and his art exemplified him as a person.
Well, what about somebody that does something really, really vile? Are you able to still respect them as an artist, such as Victor de Silva?
Well, I mean, Victor de Silva, yes. Let me go with one that's a little bit more familiar to me. Would be Roman Polanski.
I was going to go there later because I have a whole spiel on him. But
well,
okay.
we'll get there. But just to tell you that Roman Polanski, I can separate him from his art. His movies that he has made. Amazing movies. He's
a good
filmmaker.
I can't. He should not have been allowed to continue to make films because he should have been fucking in prison.
Well, yes.
He ran like a little bitch after trying to pay off a 14-year-old girl for drugging her and sodomizing her. And then when he got caught, he ran like a little bitch to a non-extradition country and said, I'll just make movies here. And then that also brings up the other question. Okay, he did that. He got caught once.
Right.
Do pedophiles stop? No, they don't. You know he was still continuing to do this in France while making these beautiful films. No. That man is a despicable human being. And when I see people like Kevin Smith and Johnny Depp and all these people coming out on his side and talking about how, oh, it was 30 years ago, just let it go. You know, Johnny Depp actually said, the man's a genius. All geniuses have quirks. Yeah, you know, fucking 14-year-old girls up the ass while you drug them and then pay them off after and running like a little bitch. That's a quirk for a filmatic genius, right? No, it's fucking not.
I would agree with you that he should be in jail. I will agree with you that what he did was absolutely despicable. I can still see that his films are beautiful.
I can't. It's all clouded by the fact that this is a pedophilic rapist making these. Same thing with Victor Da Silva. And even like Kevin Smith and Johnny Depp, when they come out on his side, I lose a ton of respect for them.
Now, for those that don't know, fill them in on Victor Da Silva.
Victor Da Silva, most people will know him. He got famous for the movie Powder, which I don't even know if that would be considered fame.
I remember that one.
Okay, and then he did the Jeepers Creepers movies.
Okay.
Creepers 1 and 2. Well, way back before that, he made a movie called Clown House. And it starred a 13-year-old boy who every night after shooting Da Silva took into his trailer and brutally raped. Da Silva was sentenced to prison for this. Now, he gets out of prison, and every movie he's made is full of scantily clad teenage boys.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I cannot watch a movie from a fucking pedophilic rapist. And he actually had this spiel that he paid his debt to society. Yeah, and then you fill all your movies with, you know, teenage boys that clearly are what turn you on, and you're a sick motherfucker. I cannot separate someone like Victor Da Silva from his films. I can't.
I can understand that.
And like Hart Fisher, the reason that came up was Hart had a project come up where he was offered a job, and it was working with Victor. And he said, no, I don't care what you pay me. I'm not working with this scumbag. No. You know, I don't care if he's reformed or paid his debt to society. I'm never working with Victor Da Silva or any pedophilic piece of shit.
So I guess to draw a parallel in another world would be the entire Sandusky scandal.
Exactly. I mean, how can you even go and watch those old games and not know that after that game he was celebrating by sticking his dick in a child's ass?
But he wasn't enjoying it.
I'm being serious.
So am I. That's his defense.
I mean, can you watch any of those games? Has that not clouded your enjoyment of even the past works?
Well, I was never a Penn State fan to begin with, so...
I'm asking the audience.
But yeah, I can understand that. These are truly horribly vile, vile things.
But you got all these people, like you even have people defending Victor Da Silva coming out going, you know, he paid his debt and, you know, we saw, you know, he's being monitored and all this and, you know, let him make his movies. The only reason I even saw Jeepers Creepers, I didn't know that was a Victor Silva movie until I was seeing it. I was in the theater. Otherwise, I would have never patronized a movie from that fuck. You know me. I actually am one of those few people that have those convictions and say, no, yeah, I'm not breaking that shit. And
you stand up to them.
And so... And like Powder, that's the first time I heard of it because I didn't see Clown House and it doesn't look like it was a very good movie to begin with, but that's not the point. The point is you've got these people that do these vile, horrible things or even people, because the reason that this came up and that this is in the news again, you know, whether separating the man from the art is Orson Scott Card. You familiar with science fiction author Orson Scott Card?
I've heard of his works.
Well, they're making Ender's Game, the first of his Ender's trilogy, into a $250 million huge major motion picture.
Okay.
Fair enough. They were good books. I liked the Ender's books. Okay. I never read Ender's Game. I read the second and third ones. I never read the first one. Well, Orson Scott Card is a militant anti-homosexual crusader, gives millions of dollars a year to anti-gay causes, and has outright said that homosexuality is a sin against God. Are you able to separate that from his science fiction work? Are you, you know, there are people that are protesting just based on who he is and what he said. So that's why I'm asking, would you be able to go see Ender's Game knowing that it was written by a raging homophobe? Even if there's nothing, you know, anti-gay in the film itself, because I don't, at least the two Ender's books I read didn't have anything anti-gay in them that I remember.
And see, that's where it comes in. I mean, if in doing, in writing those books and in Ender's Game and in the other two books of the trilogy, there was, we've talked about it in the past, the message hammer.
Yes.
If there was a message hammer of gay is wrong, boom, then yeah, no, it probably wouldn't be for me because, well, obvious fucking reasons. But if that message isn't there and if it's still a good story and still a good film, can I go knowing that I'm at least supporting other people? You know, I mean, promoting or supporting Orson Scott Card and giving some money. He's still alive, yes?
Yes.
Okay. So giving him some money, obviously, he's going to get a set amount of money whether I go see it or not.
But here is the other thing. He is going to get even more money if this movie's a hit. Mm-hmm. And then there are sequels made which allows him to give more money to anti-gay causes. So there is a cause and effect. So
okay.
Are you able to go see Ender's Game? I mean, they don't even have a trailer out for it yet, but would you be able to go see Ender's Game in 2013 knowing that Orson Scott Card is a raging homophobe?
I don't know.
You don't know if it would cloud your enjoyment of the film?
I really don't know. I mean, you know, but with films, you have so many people involved. Let's say that Alex Jowski, we'll pick him.
Okay.
Let's say Alex Jowski gets picked and they go, guess what, Alex? You get to direct. I realize this is ludicrous, but they say, you know, we've enjoyed Geek Juice Media so much that we're giving you a $250 million movie to direct right out of the box. So going to see this film, yeah, you'll be giving money to Orson Scott Card, but you'll be supporting Alex Jowski, and who knows if it's
to
a
me,
hit,
you gotta
then
take,
there you go.
You got to make a stand.
Okay.
You know, and I'm not advocating censorship. You know me. I'm as anti-censorship as they come. I'm saying you're voting with your dollar, whether you care about this or not. Okay, how about this? Something that has been whitewashed out of the popular interpretation of a certain character, such as Conan. Robert E. Howard was a Klan member. He actually is on record saying that he thought blacks were subhuman.
Right.
And if you read all the early Conan stories that he wrote and for the pulp magazines, blacks are just this side of talking monkeys. But that's kind of been whitewashed with all the comic books and the movies and the TV show
and
all
Grace
that.
Jones.
Yeah, and Grace Jones and all that. On Wilt Chamberlain.
Yep, Wilt Chamberlain as well.
So what it comes down to is if you support Conan, I mean, Robert E. Howard's long dead, so you're not supporting him anymore. But does it take a little bit of enjoyment out of it knowing just how brutally racist those original Conan stories were?
Well, now, when were these original Conan stories written?
1920s.
No.
It doesn't.
It really doesn't, because I have family members who were Klan members. I had a grandfather who was a Grand Dragon. Doesn't mean I love him any less. It means I think that one particular aspect of his life is stupid, and I think he's short-sighted on it, and yeah, I kind of see that as a stain in our family history, but I still loved my grandpa when he was alive. And given that this was the 1920s, we've talked about this before, art in context. Blatant racism was almost accepted.
Oh, I'm sure.
Even
I'm sure those
then.
Stories were completely accepted. I'm sure not one of the editors of Weird Tales or anything balked at the depiction of blacks. And
right.
I'm sure they didn't balk at all. But I'm saying, looking at it from a modern eye, doesn't it kind of just sicken you just a little bit?
No.
To know that those stories were so blatantly racist?
See, it really doesn't. Just because, again, I look at You say looking at it with a modern eye. Well, looking at things with a modern eye, you lose context. And we've talked about this with comic book. You've even brought this up to Lewis Lovog when he reviews a comic book out of context of things, and you get upset with that. Well, this is, I'm drawing a similar line here.
But see, I'm drawing the line that I can't enjoy the original stories for their blatant race because of the blatant racism. I can enjoy the Conan that I grew up with, which was the Marvel Comics Conan, right. The Savage Sword of Conan, right. The movies, etc. To me, they're almost different. Well, I mean, they're really different characters from the way they're written.
Right.
Because Conan was not this huge muscle-bound dude with long hair. He actually looked more like Charlton Heston in the original stories. He was skinny, but buff and stuff. And he is a very different character. And
right.
He was not even a barbarian. He wore full armor and everything.
And so, he was considerably more intelligent than the movies give him credit for. And
The comics have always had Conan being very smart. The comics have always played Conan up as being very intelligent.
The Conan I know is the one from the movies. Yeah, Arnold. I've got the modern one. I haven't seen it yet.
What about the TV series in the 90s? Do you remember that?
Don't remember it at all.
You remember Ralph Mueller? He was the huge dude in Beer Fest.
Yes.
He was Conan in the TV series. Okay. Lasted one season in first run syndication in late 90s. It was part of that when we talked about it in the first run syndication boom that came out after Hercules.
Sure.
This stuff's palatable again.
Sure.
So Conan ran for a full season with Ralph Mueller in the role of Conan.
I'm sure it's interesting.
But then, okay, how about something, you got the racism angle and whatnot. How about something like, are you able to separate music from the people that make the music? Such as when Rob Halford of Judas Priest, I've never been a Judas Priest fan to begin with.
Okay.
Nothing to do with homophobia. Never been a fan of their music. They're so repetitive and so baseline. Just
not a Priest fan.
Yeah.
Okay.
When Rob Halford came out as gay, all his fans were like, oh my God, I can never listen to this stuff again. And in this one case, they might be kind of right. Those old songs were filled with references to homosexuality. You just didn't notice them when you didn't know Rob Halford was gay.
So you didn't know where it was coming from.
Yes.
You didn't.
So
have
when
meaning.
You look back at them now, you go, "Man, these things are so gay."
And see, this is another thing where context comes into play, because not having the knowledge that Rob Halford was gay, you didn't have the context, and you're like, "Yeah, give it to the bitches," and
and then you go, "Oh, then you were the bitch.
Oh, wait a minute,
you were the bitch. Exactly. Oh shit."
You know, I mean, well, to me, that's, I don't care, because that's very short-sighted.
I'm just saying, I know a lot of metal fans that as soon as Rob Halford came out of the closet, they just got rid of, they sold all their Judas Priest albums.
And that's a shame. I think that, again,
you know, cause if you liked him in 19, you know, if you liked him the day before he came out of the closet,
yeah.
I don't see why him coming out of the closet would make them any different.
I don't either. I don't either. We're talking about, this is a, I would see that as a personality flaw.
All right. Then let me go to this one. This one, incredibly controversial in the early 90s.
Okay.
When Guns N' Roses recorded a song written by Charles Manson, the controversy over that how dare you record a song written by that man? No response at all?
I'm thinking, because I can see why the controversy is there, but let's face it, Manson is, was,
well, he's still alive.
He's still alive, but he was a, the Manson trial and the murders and everything like that, that was a, I have no other way of describing it other than one of those fixed points in time that Doctor Who talks about every now and then. It was
the late 70s.
It was a big thing that happened. And Manson, much like many people on death row, which
he's
realize
he's not on death
I
row.
Know he's not on death row, but he was at one time.
Yes.
But, you know, like many people on death row, like many, clown face murderer. John Wayne Gacy sold his art.
They're still selling his art.
Yeah, my father-in-law has like 3 paintings by him.
Yeah, so.
And, you know, it's a fascinating little piece of art because of who created it. I can tell you that they're crap paintings.
Well, but about the Guns N' Roses Manson thing? Are you
it's a shock value thing by a band that in the 90s was going for shock value, especially I'm guessing this was after November Rain and
I think this was on the Lies album. I might be wrong.
Okay.
So I think this was after their huge superstar rise. And before the Use Your Illusions, it might be one of the songs on Use Your Illusions, but quite a while since I've heard it.
But nonetheless, it's a fascinating little piece of art because of who it's attached to. Is it a good song?
It's not a particularly bad song. It's an average song.
Okay.
It's not a great song. It's not a
But bad what song. Sets it above being average is by who, you know.
It's written by Charles fucking
who
Manson.
Who wrote it, yeah. Can I blame him for cashing in on that? No. Is it kind of a douche move? Is it spun something I expect from Axl? Yes.
But are you able to separate that? If you had, for instance, say you loved the song, okay?
Just okay.
For the sake of argument, you absolutely loved the song. You did not know Charles Manson wrote it. Then you find out Charles Manson wrote it. What all of a sudden, like we just said about the Judas Priest thing, you kind of, ugh.
It would
I can't listen to this anymore.
It would give me a new context with which to look at it. I'd have to look at the lyrics and see what it is, and maybe this new context would completely twist that message into something I don't like, which, this may justify the Rob Halford fans selling all of their Judas Priest stuff. Is that it twists those lyrics into a new meaning. You have a new context to look at it in. And
not making a gay joke, the lyrics can go both ways.
Right. Is Charles Manson writing a song about how much he loves his kitty cat? Well, everybody loves their kitty cats, you know.
You ever see that photoshopped image of the unreleased Danzig album, Songs About My Cats? You ever see that?
No, I didn't see it. I'll have to look that one up. But you know, is he singing about how much he loves his kitty cat? Is he singing about how much prison sucks? Is he writing about how much killing is a fun and good time and how everybody should... I know he never killed anybody.
Yes, but and I'm not blaming you, but that's a common misconception. People always go, oh, he's a murderer.
No, he's not.
Technically
he's,
not. Legally, he's not a murderer. He did not kill anybody.
No, he's just...
He was convicted of conspiracy.
At the time, he was a very persuasive asshole.
Yes.
And I'm actually kind of glad he's in prison because I think more damage has been done by very persuasive assholes than... By Jim murderers.
Jim Jones. There's no evidence Jim Jones ever actually personally killed anybody.
Right.
Yeah, he made them all drink the tainted Kool-Aid, but he didn't personally taint the Kool-Aid.
He did personally. There are recordings of him ordering executions.
But it's a difference if you order an execution than pull the trigger yourself. Especially in the eyes of the law, there's a big fucking difference.
Yes, I know. But, you know, again... It would give me a new context to look at the song. Whether that would taint how I felt about it or not, I don't know.
All right, then how about this? How about when an actor, they're so great in their early films, and then they become a living parody of themselves later down the line. Are you able to watch those good films again? I'm looking at this like Steven Seagal. Those first 5 or 6 movies, I absolutely loved those. And now he is such a fat, egotistical, sex slave keeping, never showing up on set, refused to do his own lines, egomaniac. To me, it really does taint a little bit. Like when I watch Out for Justice, I just kind of go, God, what happened to this dude?
No, I look at it through nostalgia glasses, you know. Looking back, Bloodsport was Jean-Claude Van Damme. Jean-Claude Van Damme kind of lost it there for a little while. But a lot of his early films are absolutely incredible. You know, there's the fight coordination incredible. The stuff that he's able to do is a lot of fun. Are they deep, character-rich, drama-driven films? No, but I can still watch them and enjoy them. And Steven Seagal, the same thing. I can still enjoy their early work.
How about this then, staying with Steven Seagal? Sarah Lewis from Team Snob. Brad Jones showed her. Now, she only knew Steven Seagal from the direct-to-video era, from the fat, you know, arrogant era.
Steven Seagal.
Yeah, and she had never seen any of his 90s movies.
Okay.
Brad went and showed them to her, and he said, she actually said, I never thought this guy actually was a legitimate action star. She couldn't see that fat piece of crap having once been so good at what he did.
Right.
Because she'd only experienced the fat piece of crap.
Right. And that makes sense to me. I mean, if you... it's like watching anybody in a profession that they used to be really, really good at, and you watch them fall. You know, people... I think people, for the most part, there's two types of people out there. There are those that love watching the downfall of a really great person.
Oh, yes. There's no denying that.
And then there's the person that can empathize with that and go, oh, I have failed myself. I know how you feel.
I've talked about that before, especially when it comes to like Orson Welles. What is the one image that everyone has of Orson Welles?
The fucking peas.
No, not actually. The dominant image in popular culture is him drunk, big and fat with the beard, and him drunk on the Paul Masson commercial. This drunken hack.
Yes.
And it's like, why do we remember that Orson Welles instead of the Orson Welles of War of the Worlds, instead of the Orson Welles of Citizen Kane, instead of the Orson Welles of Touch of Evil? Why do we remember the failure Orson Welles over the success Orson Welles?
Because that was such an unbelievable drop of a person.
And see, I can't agree with you on this.
But you know, when it comes to Orson Welles, I do remember the great Orson Welles. I remember War of the Worlds. I grew up listening to it. I grew up having that wonderful radio broadcast in my mind and the theater of the mind that goes with it and everything like that. I mean, yeah, everybody, Godfather, Marlon Brando. How come everybody, when you mention Marlon Brando, they immediately go to the fat guy in the,
Island of Dr. Moreau.
What do you ask for on this the day of my daughter's
wedding? Oh, no. No, most people remember Marlon Brando even either wanting a woman to sodomize him with butter or the completely out of his mind Island of Dr. Moreau Marlon Brando.
Yeah, why do we remember that and not Marlon Brando of old? It's because we weren't exposed as much to those films. Those early films, for most people, I can't say everybody, but for most people, those early films didn't touch them in the way that those that grew up watching The Rise of Marlon Brando were touched.
Well, to go back to Orson Welles for a second, once you know, see, this is the reason I disagree with that. It's the way you put it was such a fall. And the reason I disagree with that is especially if you study why he fell, and none of it was his own fault. And I'm not trying to put blame on everyone except Welles, but the studios never let him have Final Cut again. He was never allowed in the editing room. His funding was constantly falling through. He had become such a pariah in Hollywood that he had made himself unhireable by demanding quality so much on those earlier films and fighting for it. He'd given himself the reputation of a troublemaker, so no one in Hollywood was willing to work with him again. So with that in your mind, does that color his fall for you anymore? That he was trying so hard, but nobody would work with the man anymore?
So he compromised himself.
No, he didn't. He didn't compromise. He kept plugging away, and it just kept getting taken away from him by lawyers. It kept he'd be like, all right, I made the movie. Here's my cut. They're like, all right, according to this loophole in the contract, we now have cut. You know, he kept getting fucked by his lawyers. Or not his lawyers, the studio's lawyers.
Well, I mean, it's a shame. Doesn't make him any worse pieces of art.
But that's what I'm saying. But that, does it cloud your image of the man then? Because you were using the terrible art that he made in the late 70s and in the early 80s, which all of it wasn't terrible. I mean, have you ever seen the and I'm doing air quotes, documentary F for Fake?
No.
It has one of the most brilliant cons I've ever seen in my life.
Okay.
And he sets you up for it in a way you never see. F for Fake is not a documentary in a traditional sense. Okay? You got to remember, this is like 74 or so. It's cut like an MTV music video. This is actually where that kind of cutting pattern, what we call music video editing, right, comes from.
Okay.
The documentary is about art fakery. Okay? Art forgery. Well, here's the thing. He opens the documentary narrating it, talking about how for the next hour, everything you see and hear in this movie is absolutely true. We have not embellished any of this.
Okay.
The movie's 90 minutes long. Do you see what he did there?
For the next hour.
So everything in the last half hour is fake.
Ah.
Brilliant. That's the kind of brilliance that when he had a truly independent production and no one taking the movie from him, the kind of shit he did. That's fucking genius, is it not?
Yes, it is.
And then once you finally figure out that whole last half hour is fake, you at first you feel like you've been taken. But then when you go back and you go, wait a minute, he only told us that everything in the next hour is real. That's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant.
Yes.
So to me, that should cause respect for Orson Welles to go up in those later years.
All right, then let's take a more recent example, George Lucas.
Okay.
Okay. 77, Star Wars comes about. Is it original? No.
Even before that, THX-1138.
THX-1138. You know, but. Yeah, you watch TH. Frankly, I find the film boring.
I love the short film. The original 16mm student film version. I haven't
seen it.
It's like 18, 20 minutes long. Way better. And it is cut like a 70s student film, which gives it a really unique feel. It's actually as an extra on the DVD.
Okay.
They actually have it on the DVDs.
Good, I'll have to find it. But nonetheless, so he's lauded as a genius. He's lauded as a brilliant filmmaker. Star Wars comes around. He does his thing. He fights for it. He gets it up there. He's lauded as a genius.
I'm going to stop you real quick.
Okay.
He's not a genius. The other producers on Star Wars were a genius. Did you ever read his script for Star Wars?
No.
It is horrendous what he wanted to do. Han Solo was a fish creature. Chewbacca was like a big hairless ape creature. Luke Skywalker was named Star Killer. Almost the entire movie was basically all three movies jammed into one. There was no plot development whatsoever.
All right,
all the characters were so taken in such ridiculously stupid directions. It was one of those ones where the rewrites are where Star Wars came out. Go out and read his original script. It is fucking terrible. If he had had full control, that's the movie we would have gotten. So I will fight you that he's a genius.
Okay, but I mean, he was seen.
He was seen as a genius.
I'm not going to argue whether he's a genius or not, because he's clearly not.
Okay, when you add that extra word, that makes a big difference in what you were saying.
He was seen as a genius. He was lauded as a genius for this film that he makes. And, you know, now, I hate to say it, Mr. Lucas, but you're kind of becoming a joke.
Oh, simply he has been for a long time.
Simply because he's going back, number one, making the prequels and having most of Star Wars fandom go, what?
And see, okay, this is the best way to put what I was talking about with that script. Those prequels are far more in line with the stupid shit he wanted to do originally. But they would not let him.
Okay.
But then I saw a meme recently that had a picture of George Lucas, and it said, isn't it ironic that sometimes you live so long you become a villain in your own story? And I thought, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
He's become the villain of the Star Wars universe, hasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
He's become the villain of moviedom. And I don't think undeservedly so.
Both the creator and the destroyer of it.
Yeah. So, you know, George Lucas is one. And yes, you're right. I'm not able to separate the man from the work there. To me, knowing what George Lucas is now does taint the early stuff, because having read that original Star Wars script and knowing what Lucas wanted to do, I watched the three real Star Wars movies, and I just keep saying to myself, I don't think Lucas had yes, he directed the first one. I don't think he had all that much creative push, especially on Empire. He didn't even write Empire or co-write Empire.
Right.
Because he was making Willow at that time.
Right.
So he wasn't even, they've said he wasn't even on set most days. Funny how that turns out to be the best one, the darkest one, and the most un-Star Wars one. Then Lucas takes back the reins, and you get the Ewoks and Nub Nub.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it funny how it seems like he always had someone running interference for his, and I'm using quotes again, genius. Because it needed to be stopped because they said the public's going to revolt if we just let him do what he wants.
Okay.
Yes, he gets to do what he wants. This is never going to make money if he just gets to do what he wants.
So, all right. I can see that, but, you know.
So to me, that even goes back to, you know, watching THX-1138, and you see, you know, like that long, drawn-out car chase scene in the underground tunnel and that, and you go, early pod race.
Yeah.
You know, that you can even see then, Lucas still had people pulling him back from the brink of insanity. So I'm not able to separate the man I've seen today from his early work. I'm not able to do that.
Now, you're not an Apple fan, right?
No.
I mean, are you an anti-fan of Apple? Would you?
I eat apples.
No.
I know. That's a smart-ass remark.
Right.
I don't like this whole think differently, but just like everybody else philosophy of the iPod. And I don't get the Apple. They call themselves Apple enthusiasts. I call them Apple worshipers.
Apple fanboys, right.
These people are insane. Apple, 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 Apple.
Well, it was well known that Steve Jobs, number one, I'm going to put everybody's mind to rest. No, Jobs didn't have much to do with the design. But he did run that company with an iron fist. And he did do one thing amazingly well, and that was say no.
To dumb ideas or
to,
what?
To we want to open up Apple to clones. Go right ahead. I'm going to go for him next. And then when he came back, he went, no more clones. We're done. We do our computer. They wanted to design, the original design for the iPhone was much closer to a BlackBerry with a keyboard and everything like that. And he went, no, go design me something that's touchscreen and useful. The original iPad had a slide out keyboard on it. And had a lot more buttons and slidey bits. It was like the original was like this.
It was like a slide rule for
like,
a computer.
It was like a tablet, but all of the little extra things like the camera and everything else like that all slid out of the tablet. And it had like six buttons on it.
I'm just getting the picture of the glaive from Krull. Yeah, remember kinda, that?
Yes.
I'm just feeling like, you know, all these different blades come out.
Yes, it was almost the Swiss Army tablet, really. but, you know, and Steve Jobs said, no, go back and design me something better. And he was well known for his temper. He was well known for mistreating his employees, for just getting down on his employees, coming in on a bad day and going, you're fired.
Oh, yeah. I read shortly after his death, Wired did a big expose article on what a tyrannical dictator he was.
Well, Walter Isaacson did a biography of Steve Jobs. And it was a well-written book if you're at all interested in it. That's an e-cig, Kat. You don't need that. if you're at all interested, it's a good read. But, you know, he was a huge dick. So do you separate that man from his art, which was the company that he ran?
Which to me, like I said, I'm not an Apple fan. I mean, the only reason I even have an iPod is you sold me your broken one.
Yep.
Although, and that's it. I have no desire to upgrade. I don't need a new one. I barely have, the only reason I have iTunes is so we could get our show on it.
Right.
Because I needed to have it to get into it.
Right. And to tell you the truth, you're getting, as soon as I replace that iPod, I'm just giving it to you.
Oh, all right then.
That's the way it is.
But then, okay, what happens when when the person makes it impossible to separate them from their art? Examples would be such as like when a pro, someone comes out of the closet, say a filmmaker like Clive Barker, okay?
Okay.
And there was almost nothing gay before he came. I mean, he was always kind of out. I mean, in the horror community, you always kind of knew he was gay, and some of his early stories make it pretty clear.
Right.
After Clive Barker came out of the closet publicly, and he's on the cover of magazines and things like that, you start to see a homosexual element in almost everything he wrote, drew, or made as a film.
But see,
so he kind of said, I am now a gay filmmaker. I'm a gay writer. I am a gay painter. And that's part of where I'm going.
Okay. But again, that's, I bought a Ford Taurus. Okay. I drive a Ford Taurus. I didn't notice many Ford Tauri on the road.
Is that the plural?
Yes. Now I see them freaking everywhere. When I drove a Volkswagen Beetle, I thought, gee, I'm pretty unique. I don't see too many other Volkswagen Beetles on the road.
I remember your bug.
Yeah. And when I drove the bug, it was like everywhere I looked, I was like, there's another bug. There's another bug. There's another bug. And that is something in your brain where, if you're not,
you just don't notice it.
If you're not looking for the pattern, you don't notice it. If something triggers that you're looking for that pattern, whether, you know, I drive a bug now, or I'm interested in buying a Mini Cooper, and I didn't see too many Mini Coopers till I started looking into buying one, and then I saw them freaking everywhere. And I think the same thing happens there, where, you know, an artist comes out of the closet, Halford or Clive Barker comes out of the closet, and all of a sudden you look back over his filmography or his discography, and all of that, and you suddenly go, aha, when he was talking about bending over and getting it in the park, we all thought he meant bending her over and getting into the park. What he really meant was him bending over and getting it in the park.
Well, let me ask you this then. There was a huge controversy in the late 90s when, and this is something that was never hidden. It was just one of those things that, like you pointed out, people didn't see until it was pointed out to them. Larry Flint. People could not separate Larry Flint from all the non-Hustler magazines that Larry Flint Publications put out there. It really came about with Kathy Lee Gifford, where she did like a huge, you know, in-depth interview with like Bridal Monthly or something, like some bridal magazine. And then she sued them to have it pulled when she found out that magazine was published by Larry Flint Publications. She said she'll have nothing to do with that man. Doesn't matter that she completely endorsed the magazine the day before. It was Larry Flint runs this and he's getting the money. No, I'm not doing that.
So what if LFP published everything they publish that's not an adult magazine? They would still be a very successful business.
But you got to remember, this was at a time when LFP was in every genre. They published game tips right. and tricks. They published photography magazines, right. A yacht magazine. Cinescape, the sci-fi magazine.
That's what I'm saying. What if, you know, would she have thrown that much of a hissy fit if LFP had never published Hustler?
LFP wouldn't have been able to publish all these magazines.
I realize that. We're playing pretend here.
I don't think so. I think to her it was, Larry Flint is one of the most vile human beings on the planet, and I will not put money in his pocket. So she sued to have her interview removed, you know, not published in this magazine. I don't remember exactly which magazine it was.
Right.
And I'm saying, when it comes to something like that, most people, until that controversy kicked up in like 96, 97, whenever that was, most people never even looked at the masthead
right.
to see editor-in-chief Larry Flint. You know, I mean,
let alone the colophon. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you see that, you know, well, Film Threat and Cinescape and, you know, the TurboGrafx-16 magazine and, yep. and, you know, Photography Today and Yacht Monthly. And you just kind of go, what's the big deal? Unless Larry Flint's politics start leaching into the magazines, which they absolutely did not.
Right. In fact, he was
basically hands off.
Yeah. He always fought against that, actually.
So unless his politics started leaching into the magazines, what's the problem? Why would Kathy Lee Giffords throw such a fit over Larry Flint publishes this?
Because she has conviction, just like you. You won't go see a Roman Polanski movie. You won't pay to see a Roman Polanski movie. You won't.
But
you know.
She actually sued to get her interview removed. You know, I realize things changed in her head once she found out it was published by LFP. But you already committed to it. You took the money. You can't just go at that point, I want the money back, and you don't get the interview. I don't think you can just do that.
I don't know.
That's a little more douchier than me going, I refuse to go to a Roman Polanski movie. Now, if she said, no, I will not do an interview for your magazine because it's published by Larry Flint, absolutely, I'd absolutely be on her side. The fact that she already did it and then tried to have it pulled, that's where I'm having an issue.
Well, what, I mean, would she say, okay, the money you gave me for the interview, here it is back. I don't want it. I don't want.
She didn't want the interview in a Larry Flint
right.
magazine.
Was she willing to give the money they paid her for it back?
I don't remember. I don't remember actually how that turned out. I don't remember if they settled out of court or.
Well, I was going to say,
or if that ended up getting printed. I'm not
would
sure.
Would that have changed things if she, you know, obviously if she went.
If
no.
she had given all the money back and everything had been returned back to zero, then I would not have a problem.
Okay.
But one thing, there was also the side effect of. She was getting so much extra publicity out of the fact that she was throwing a fit over this, which got other magazines to come to her and go, would you do an interview for our magazine then? So she still profited from this, no matter what.
Oh, and I guarantee LFP did too.
Because no, actually LFP got hit with a lot of blowback. A lot of people, since people didn't realize that those magazines like Photography Monthly were published by LFP, sales went down immediately after and never rose back up. And within about 2 years, most of those magazines were out of business because people went, I'm not buying a video game magazine put out by Larry Flint.
Okay.
It was one of those like an open secret. Once everybody knows about it, Larry lost, you know, his reputation preceded him basically. And everyone is associated Larry Flint with Hustler. And that's it. Doesn't matter what else he publishes. Larry Flint is Hustler.
Well, Stallone is Rocky.
No, Stallone's Rambo to most people, I think.
I don't know. I'd fight you on that one. But, you know, Stallone is Rocky. Stallone is Rambo. RoboCop is...
Peter Weller. I saw you struggle for a second.
Yeah, it was...
He's not this transforming Batman-looking dude in the new movie.
You know, I'm, and that's where a lot of people are getting blowback there. To me, Superman, Christopher Reeves. There is no other Superman.
Is that like even if you picture the comics, you picture Christopher Reeve kind of his face?
I hear his voice. Like with comics, I can look at the art and I can go, okay, that's a stylized Christopher Reeve.
So you absolutely do not see Brandon Routh?
No, not one bit.
Or the dude from the TV show?
No, Lewis and Clark. Nope, don't see him. Or the kid from Smallville.
His name escapes me right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, me but. Too, but... Yeah, I don't see, you know, those. It, in fact, I forget what we were watching, but it was something else starring the dude from Lois and Clark.
Okay.
And he was out of the Superman stuff. Dean Cain?
Dean Cain, that's
Dean
it.
Dean
Cain. Yes.
People were shouting at their radios up until that point. It's Dean Cain, you stupid idiots!
You guys are idiots!
You know.
Look it up!
But the... I don't see him as Superman, and I saw him in another film, and she goes, oh, yeah, he's from Lois and Clark. No, the only, you know.
To you, Superman is Christopher
to
Reeve.
To me, right? Superman is Christopher Reeve, period. He did the role so perfectly, even with the shit scripts he was handed for 3 and 4.
Richard Pryor was still funny in 3. But okay.
In bits. I'll give you that.
There were very Richard Pryor moments that clearly looked like ads to me.
You know, to tell you the truth, the 3 really was a Richard Pryor movie that happened to have Superman in it.
Yeah.
You know, and 4 was just...
Except Christopher Reeve had full control. Christopher Reeve wrote, directed, and starred in that piece of crap.
So look,
Christopher
look,
Reeve
look.
Gets all blame for Superman look, Quest for Peace.
When it comes to Quest for Peace, you can be an amazing actor and you can play a part perfectly. And you can still have the ability to fail at writing and directing.
he later co-wrote an episode of The Practice he starred in, and it was chilling, too.
Okay, maybe he got better. But, you know, not everybody can be a Leonard Nimoy. You know, but the simple fact is, you know, there I can't separate. Like, that's a character that I can't separate from. Because even in the comics, the few comics that I read, the one that came out in the 90s, The Death of Superman.
Yep.
The first, it was the only friend loaned it to me and went, here, I know you want to see this because it's a thing. And I said, great, okay. And I read it, and every line of Superman's dialogue, I'm hearing Christopher Reeve in the back of my head saying them.
Okay, how about an actor such as William Shatner? Are you able to separate Captain Kirk or even Denny Crane from, you see him in some very dramatic 70s TV movie or something, or do you just go, why is Captain Kirk in a leisure suit killing women?
There's only been one thing where I could separate the Kirk from Shatner.
Denny Crane?
No. No, I still see, it's like...
Kirk as a lawyer?
Yeah, Kirk as a lawyer. But there's only been one thing where I can truly separate him out, and that is the episode of The Twilight Zone.
You need to see his Thriller episodes.
Okay,
he did 2 episodes of Thriller, and he is great in those. Boris Karloff's Thriller. He is just great in those 2.
Okay. But, no, that's another one that I can't... I even see him on our... He does local commercials for a law firm, Hubie and Abraham.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm just like...
I see Denny Crane there.
Well,
because of the law firm thing.
There I look and I go, why is Fat Kirk... talking about motorcycle accidents, you know.
I actually, when I see those commercials, at any moment I expect them to go, call Hupie and Abraham, Denny Crane. You know, I'm just expecting a Denny Crane at the end of that.
Someday they'll change their firm name to Hupie, Abraham, and Crane.
Crane, Pool, and Abraham. But, you know, to me, it is very difficult for me to separate the art from the artist. Because to me, the artist... clouds is not the right word, but colors.
Influences.
Yes, yeah. It influences, it colors. And whether that's art, you know, like physical drawing art, whether it's music, whether it's movies, whether it's just ideas, whether it's writing, I can't separate that. Like, and keep in mind, I love the guy's writing and I think he's a great public speaker and whatnot, but whenever I read anything by Harlan Ellison, the angry curmudgeon is still at the back of my head going, this angry curmudgeon wrote this. You know,
you are an angry curmudgeon. So,
but I don't have I don't even have a tenth of the talent that Harlan Ellison has.
But nonetheless, and I can in some cases, I can separate the art from the artist. I can enjoy Mapplethorpe's photography.
Mapplethorpe's photography was fucking brilliant.
Yes,
it was.
I can
beautiful.
Enjoy his photography without thinking about the lifestyle of the man. I can
to a degree. When you see, you know, the finger in the penis and the bullwhip up the ass and the dude pissing in another dude's mouth and stuff, you kind of can't not look at the homosexual aspect of
that.
Well,
no, that's not what I'm talking about. I don't need to worry about Mapplethorpe's personal sex life and what he does in the bedroom compared to what he photographs.
Okay.
I can separate them there. In some, Reeve portraying Superman, you know... I can't separate them at all. In some, I get a new context. For instance, Halford coming out of the closet. You get a new context for his lyrics. Knowing that a song was written by...
Manson.
You get a new context for those lyrics. Does it mean I have to separate them, or does it just mean another insight into the art? I don't know.
But sometimes that insight becomes a separation. And unfortunately, that's where we're going to have to end because we're running out of time.
Yeah.
So thank you for listening to Lost in Static and listening to us prattle on for the last 55 minutes.
Definitely. Bless you. And again, Adam and Eve, use the code static. and you get a nice deal. So thanks a bunch for joining us. We will see you next week to talk about more gay men and neat things they've done.
Same bat time, same bat channel.
Bye, everybody.